Frank Muir goes into The Family and investigates the humor of the subject with the help of Alfred Marx.
A father was talking to his son. Now listen, my boy, from now on you do your own homework. I'm not going to do any more for you. It's not right. I know, said the boy, but have a shot at it just the same, wouldn't you? Tell me, young man, said the father to his potential son-in-law, if my daughter marries you and I give her a substantial dowry, what have you to offer her in return? Well, I'll give you a receipt.
Grandfather?
Yes?
Grandfather, is that a new hearing aid you've got?
Now, you see that hearing aid? That's as small as the nail on my little finger. God. And it's Japanese and they're clever. There's 48 transistors in that hearing aid. 48! And I'll just put it back in. Look, you can't see it, can you?
No. Now, how much does it cost?
Half past four.
I gave my mother-in-law a waterproof, shockproof, anti-magnetic, unbreakable watch. She went and lost it. Did you hear the one about the cannibal who got mad and at the reception toasted his mother-in-law?
Nigel, I hear you buried your mother-in-law last week.
Had to, her boy. She was dead. A Scot died and left his cousin all the money his cousin owed him. Dear old lady, walking down Whitechapel Road with two little children, and a friend said, hello. Is that your grandchildren? She said, that's my two grandchildren, my two grandsons. She said, oh, they're lovely. How old are they? She said, well, the doctor's 5 and the lawyer's 6.
Most humour about the family is pretty cool. This doesn't mean that family love doesn't exist, only that there's nothing very funny about that. As usual, the devil has the best jokes, and insults are more memorable than praise. Here's a very bitter view of family life from August Strindberg.
The family, home of all social evils, a charitable institution for indolent women, a prison workshop for the slaving breadwinner, and a hell for children.
There you are. Francis Bacon also issued a warning on the subject.
He that hath wife and children hath given hostages to fortune, for they are impediments to great enterprises either of virtue or mischief.
And the pride of an ancestral family is not very highly thought of either. Anthony Hope.
Good families are generally worse than any others.
The family as an institution is receiving quite a battering these days. It used to be regarded as one of the great symbols of order. When the natural affections between close relations ceased to exist, the fabric of society was threatened. But now the family has to resist the daily onslaughts of sociological theories, the erosion of a more mobile population, and a spirit of indifference that amounts almost to callousness. Here's an advertisement from a Tipperary newspaper.
For sale, 9 7-week-old chickens. Would sell mother 2 if needed.
And yet, most families start in hope. That's before the cynicism creeps in. The idea of starting a family is still highly regarded, and few really anticipate the problems that children can bring. Here's a rare example of foresight from an Indian newspaper.
In our last week's issue, we announced the birth of a son to Mr. and Mrs. Gilbert Parkinson. We regret any annoyance that this may have caused.
The arrival of a baby, particularly the first baby, is a major upheaval in any family. The run-up to the birth can be very hard on the expectant father, as his role is rather less clearly defined than that of the mother. Here's Bob Newhart taking his very pregnant wife to the maternity hospital.
Finally, we got inside, and you go to the admitting office. And there's a nurse there. She says, how do you do, sir? And what is your name? I said, my name is Newhart. She said, all right, Mr. Newkirk, and is this your wife? I said, no, this is the hitchhiker. She was hitchhiking down here to the hospital, and it's, you know, it's right on my way to work, and it isn't that far out of the way, so I figured I'd drop her off. And she said, well, we have to have the husband sign the paper. I said, I am the husband. I was just a little attempted humor there. And she said, now, sir, do you have Blue Cross or any other hospital plan? And I'm getting a little panicky now. I said, look, could I possibly, you know, answer the questions while you take my wife upstairs, you know? And she said, well, no, we need your wife to sign the form at the end of it, you know? So I said, well, if you wait about 15 minutes, all three of us can sign this form. It's very important. And with this, she panicked because she wasn't a nurse, it turned out. She's a clerk at the hospital, and she wouldn't know what to do, you know, if the baby came there. So she got her in the elevator and got her upstairs. And they have two wonderful rooms, wonderfully titled rooms. They call one the labor room, and the other one is called the hard labor room. In other words, you're going to scream your head off in this room, you know, which makes the wife feel great. And you're allowed now to stay with your wife for a while until she goes into the hard labor room. So finally, you take my wife into the hard labor room, and you can find nothing out from any hospital people if you're an expectant father. You are the lowest form of life in a hospital. No one, even maintenance people, will have nothing. Will have nothing to do with it. And there are people running around, you know, with various assorted pans of one kind or another, with worried looks on their faces. Right? And I don't think they're nurses. They're just people that are hired to run around looking worried, because this makes the father feel better, you know, that they're concerned. And then they have the father's room. It's sort of a torture chamber that they devised to drive the father nuts while the wife was having the baby. And this is filled with guys you just wouldn't believe. You know, they're all sitting like that. And there's one guy in there who has just had a baby, and he is superior to everybody else. You know, he's sort of gloating, you know. And, of course, I'm trying to get information out of him, you know, and I say, gee, they just took my wife into the hard labor room. Like, what will it be, 15, 20 minutes, I guess? No. So, no. Oh, no. Mm-hmm. Oh, 5, 6, 7 hours. He said, you see that poor guy over there in the corner? 32 hours he's been here. And there's a guy in the corner, he's not making any sense at all. He's going, Mom, So as I say, I don't know how the world ever got overpopulated, because we swore we would never do it again. But it has a happy ending, because we had a little son, Robert William, and he was 7 pounds, 14 ounces. And, oh, I became a father officially the other day. You're officially a father, you know, when the baby is born, but you aren't really a father until your baby has gone all over you. And my son went all over me the other day, and I'm a member of an exclusive fraternity now. But believe me, when it happens, it's wonderful.
Bob Newhart. But once the first glow of excitement has worn off, the new parents may find that there are some drawbacks to their new acquisition. Most of these drawbacks are nappies. And even if the parents remain besotted with their offspring, they may find that the rest of the world is less enthusiastic. Some people just don't like children. Dr. Johnson, for instance.
One cannot love lumps of flesh, and little infants are nothing more.
Lord Byron.
They always smell of bread and butter.
Very good, though. John Keats.
The servants have come for the little Browns this morning. They have been a toothache to me, which I shall enjoy the riddance of. Their little voices are like wasp stings.
Here's one from Edward Lear.
I was much distressed by next-door people who had twin babies and played the violin. One of the twins died, and the other one has eaten the fiddle, so all is peace.
Considering this welter of abuse, it's rather unfair that infants can't answer back. They probably have some equally scathing things to say about grown-ups. Over now to some prams outside a supermarket.
Morning, Rupert. Morning, Hugh. So your mother's been giving you beef broth again, then? You're covered in it. It's terrible, isn't it? She's such a messy feeder. What's that stain on your bib?
Fish and macaroni.
I thought I'd recognise it. Is your old woman making you feed yourself yet? Because mine is.
Good Lord, no. What cheek. Are you standing for it, Rupert?
Well, I tried non-cooperation for a few meals and I just starved. Of course, the old man was being very tough. Stupid, great idiot.
Yeah.
Stood there stuffing it in himself as a sort of demonstration effort. And then he puked.
Well, I'm not surprised the muck we get.
Actually, talking about puking, I'm a bit worried. My old lady's sick every morning and she says it's because she's having another baby. Well, I've been sick every morning for weeks. I mean, hang on, here comes Cyril and his ghastly mother.
Oh,
come
no.
on, scream, everyone.
I'm just going to get some din-dins for you, chucky-chucky-chucky.
Din-dins.
Chucky-chucky. Morning,
Cyril, sweetie.
Oh, do belt up, you fellows. I say, you two look in a right old mess.
Rupert thinks he's having a baby.
Wet nappies.
Shut up, you. Might be a rabbit for all I know.
Hey! I'm getting christened next week.
You're
how
not
about that?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I did that weeks ago.
Oh,
everybody came, I got soaked, and they had a party.
No, I must tell you, I had a laugh last week. Mother's been trying to teach me for weeks to say mammy. It's embarrassing. So just after my bath, I gave her a big smile and said,
Auntie Dory.
You see, I haven't got an Auntie Dory. I nearly killed her, my only laugh of the week.
Shut up. Shut up, for Pete's sake. Here comes the vicar. Plan B.
Daddy!
It's all right. It's all right. That shifted him. His wife looked a bit rattled, too.
Look out. Here comes your mother again, Cyril. I'll
pretend to be asleep.
Okay.
Well, well, who's asleep, then? Who's asleep? Who's asleep, then?
I am, you silly old bag and top.
David Hatch. Didn't look pale at the end. Well-deserved round of applause for David Hatch, Timbuk Taylor, John Cleese and Joe Kendall from... I'll read that again. A lot of childhood habits carry through into adult life. Some people have great difficulty in putting away childish things. Here's a letter from the Brighton and Hove Herald.
What nonsense to suggest, as your woman's page did last week, that the use of a dummy is either unhygienic or a bad habit which could become hard for a baby to break. I have derived great comfort from my dummy for over 40 years and find it gives much greater oral satisfaction than the unhealthy cigarette. It's also much cheaper.
Of course, the family extends beyond the parent-child relationship. There are lots more personalities to be resented. All those relations. Here's H.L. Mencken.
Every man sees in his relatives a series of grotesque caricatures of himself.
Oscar Wilde.
Relations are a tedious pack of people who haven't got the remotest knowledge of how to live nor the smallest instinct about when to die.
Let's have a look at a few relations. Aunts. Here's a Freudian slip from a thing called The People's Friend.
Aunts in the house are a serious nuisance and are not easily expelled once they've established a kingdom. Perhaps a chemist in your town could help you.
Well, it's less messy than Lizzie Borden, isn't it? Here's another ruthless thought about aunts from Harry Graham.
Auntie, did you feel no pain falling from that willow tree? Could you do it, please, again? Because my friend here didn't see.
Harry Graham's ruthless rhymes for heartless homes are very destructive of family solidarity. Here he is on grandmothers.
When Grandmama fell off the boat and couldn't swim and wouldn't float, Matilda just stood by and smiled. I almost could have slapped the child.
And for Grandmother's birthday, here's a special message from Hilaire Belloc.
Dear Grandmama, with what we give, we humbly pray that you may live for many, many happy years, although you bore us all to tears.
But the member of the family who suffers most from these attacks of vicious humour is, of course, the mother-in-law, who, along with Englishmen, Irishmen, Scotsmen, milkmen, policemen and commercial travellers, is part of our joke mythology. The distrust of mothers-in-law goes back as far as marriage does. Here's a part of Juvenal's sixth satire.
Be sure no quiet can arrive to you while her mama's alive.
And somewhat later, Samuel Butler.
One of the strongest proofs of Christ's personal influence over his followers is to be found in the fact of Peter's remaining on friendly terms with him, notwithstanding his having healed his mother-in-law.
I don't think we can escape at this juncture a small sequence of savage mother-in-law jokes. Alfred, go.
A young wife came home one day and found her mother standing in a bucket of water with her finger stuck in the light socket. The young husband was standing by the switch. How
Hello, darling, said the mother. George has had this marvellous idea for curing my rheumatism.
And another.
You know, I don't know what I'd do without my mother-in-law, but it's nice dreaming about it.
Number three.
I mean, she's not ugly. It's just that when she makes up, the lipstick crawls back down the tube.
Number four.
She's found a new cheap way of making yogurt and sour cream. She just buys a bottle of milk and stares at it for a couple of minutes.
And five.
Julie, my mother-in-law's vanished, just disappeared from home, just like that.
Have you given her description to the police?
Hell, they'd never believe me.
Thank you, Alfred. Good luck when you get home. And now, a sweet Irish ballad.
About a maid I'll sing a song, sing rickety-tickety-tin. About a maid I'll sing a song, who didn't have her family long. Not only did she do them wrong, she did every one of them in, she did every one of them in. One morning in a fit of pique, sing rickety-tickety-tin. One morning in a fit of pique, she drowned her father in the creek. The water tasted bad for a week, and we had to make do with gin. With gin. We had to make do with gin. Her mother, she could never stand, sing rickety-tickety-tin. Her mother, she could never stand, and so a cyanide soup she planned. The mother died with a spoon in her hand, and her face in a hideous grin, a grin, her face in a hideous grin. She set her sister's hair on fire, rickety-tickety-tin. She set her sister's hair on fire, and as the smoke and flame rose higher, danced around the funeral pyre, playing a violin, olin, playing a violin. She weighted her brother down with stones, rickety-tickety-tin. She weighted her brother down with stones and sent him off to Davy Jones. All they ever found were some bones and occasional pieces of skin, of skin, occasional pieces of skin. One day when she had nothing to do, rickety-tickety-tin. One day when she had nothing to do, she cut her baby brother in two and served him up as an Irish stew and invited the neighbors in. Invited the neighbors in. And when at last the police came by, rickety-tickety-tin. And when at last the police came by, her little pranks she did not deny. To do so she would have had to lie, and lying she knew was a sin, a sin. Lying she knew was a sin. My tragic tale I won't prolong, rickety-tickety-tin. My tragic tale I won't prolong, and if you do not enjoy my song, you've yourselves to blame if it's too long. You should never have let me begin, begin. You should never have let me begin.
Tom Lehrer, of course, for that highly moral little ballad. Alfred has remembered an old Northamptonshire rhyme about children.
As tall as your knee, they're pretty to see. As tall as your head, they wish you were dead.
There are bound to be stresses in any family. One of the big problems, as that little piece said, was the generation gap problem. Sometimes people feel the need to escape to their own age group. Samuel Butler.
There are orphanages for children who've lost their parents. Oh, why are there no harbours of refuge for grown men who haven't yet lost them?
One of the most difficult relationships can be that between father and his grown-up son who lives at home.
Is that you, Brian?
Yes, father.
What time of night do you call this thing?
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, father.
Half 4 o'clock in the morning, you, my boy. I've been sitting here since half past 11 wondering what's happened to you. I've been sitting here eating my heart out. I have to get up in 2 hours' time.
I know, father.
Time to get up at 6:30. Where have you been?
Father, I'm 28 years old. Surely I'm old enough to go where I like, with whom I like, at what time I like. I was out with friends.
Friends? Friends? I call them fiends. They're nothing but a pack of whores.
Those four, Father. No.
Yeah, you've become a regular little rolling stone ever since you opened that stupid little shop of yours.
There's nothing stupid about the boutique, Father. It happens to cater for modern trends, which you may be a little out of touch with, that's all.
Well, I thank the Lord I've lost contact with painted ties, kinky boots and PVC underwear. What sort of a bloody job is that then, eh? Wash my mouth out with soap and water. What I'd like to know is what's wrong with the drains then, eh? I've been down the drains all my life. My father before me's been down the drains, and my grandfather before me's been down the drains. The whole family's been down the drains for centuries.
Father.
I suppose you're too big to go down the drains, aren't you?
Father, the mere fact that our entire family tree grew in the drains is no reason why I should spend my life in a sewer.
If your mother was alive today, she'd have something to say about it. Oh, Rosie, Rosie, why did you leave me, my darling, to cope with such an ungrateful son?
Don't drag Mother into it, please.
I can scarcely drag your poor mother into it when she's 5 foot underground, can I? How did we spawn this fop? You're a lardy-dar, aren't you? You're too clever for your old father now, aren't you? Yes. Yes, of course you're too good for the drains. I forgot. You're a bloody marquis, aren't you? Oh, wash my mouth out with soap. Look here, my boy, I tell you, the drains are too good for you. That's what it is. I've seen better things than you floating down the drain.
I don't know why you go on about the drains. You know perfectly well you retired at 31 and you haven't been down there since.
Oh, well, I haven't been down there since you, my boy.
Don't tap me with paper, Father.
Now then, Rosie, my darling, do you see what a popping jay we have for a son? What a strutting peacock. Did I fight in the war to hear you abuse me in such a way? Eh? Did I?
I'd no idea, Father, if indeed you did fight in the war.
If indeed I did fight? Well, if indeed I did fight you, my boy.
What's this then, eh? Tell me what this is.
Tell me what that is then, go on.
That's your navel, Father.
Really? That's funny. I thought I contracted that on Dunkirk on the beach, crawling on my hands and knees to preserve you, eh?
Father, if that's a war wound, I think you'll find I've got a similar one under my
shirt. I don't want to see under your shirt. I don't want to see under your shirt. You disgust me. I've been thorough at St. Thomas's Beckentry for 45 years, and I've never seen you in that place. I've never seen you within 2 yards of its portal.
Father, I can't help being an agnostic. I wish I had faith like you.
Well, I wish I had faith like you. You, my boy. Yeah. Now then, you come in here all hours of the morning, smelling of honey and flowers and reading your Ponzi magazines and mixing your Bloody Marys. Oh, soap and water. I've got a good mind to give you a good hiding. I've got a good mind to take my belt off you.
I wouldn't do that, Father. Your trousers will fall down.
Peter Cook and Dudley Moore bringing our family programme to a close. Next week, we'll be going into the subject of class. Until then, from me and little baby Alfred, goodbye. Say goodbye.
No, I don't like you.
Frank Muir Goes Into the Family was produced by Simon Brett and Bob Oliver Rogers.